NPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Natural gas has shaken up New England energy markets just over the past few years. The current abundance, low prices, and its status as a cleaner fossil fuel has many here making the switch to gas from other energy sources, not just for heating, but electricity as well, to the point where some other power generators can't compete. The company that owns the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant cited cheap natural gas as the major reason why it decided to shut the facility down. And coal and oil-fired plants in Massachusetts and Connecticut have also closed because gas has become so much the favored alternative. From an environmental standpoint, this could be good because natural gas emits less carbon than coal and oil. But as New England relies more on natural gas, there are more voices saying lately, hold on. Despite its advertising as clean, natural gas is still a fossil fuel. It still emits carbon as well as methane during extraction. And the Independent System Operator, or ISO New England, which manages the region's power supplies and distribution, has publicly worried for some time now that an over-reliance on natural gas could lead to price shocks and energy shortages, such as we saw just this past winter during a cold snap when electricity prices skyrocketed. Today in The Exchange, natural gas in New England, rewriting the rules of regional energy. We'll look at the pros and cons of this, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment at our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests with me in studio is Sam Evans-Brown, environment reporter for NHPR. Sam, thanks for taking time out for us today.
Happy to be here.
Also with us, Greg Lander, owner of Skipping Stone, a professional resources and energy consulting firm concentrating in natural gas and electricity. And Greg Lander, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Also joining us from Maine is Steve Klemmer, Director of Energy Research in the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Steve Klemmer, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Sam, I'll start with you, but want to hear from everybody. How much has the picture changed in terms of where New England gets its electricity, say, in the last, 5 or 10 years, Sam?
Well, so in 2000, so 12 or 13 years ago, we used to get 15% of our electricity from natural gas in New England. Now, in 2000, or last year in 2012, it was up to 52%. So, I mean, it's a dramatic shift, and that really is the big story because that people are switching their home heating from natural gas, but it's occurring much more slowly because, as you can imagine, people don't swap out boilers in their house that often. However, the commodities market that is electricity responds a lot more quickly to price signals. And you know, that's where the switch has come. And it's really come at the expense of coal and oil. Oil, we used to get 22% of our electricity from oil, and it's now less than 1%.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a dramatic change.
That is a dramatic change. 15% a little more than a decade ago to more than 50 today. And we're talking about mostly electric generation. That's the big change.
Yes, and like I said, there are other shifts occurring. There's even people talking about switching trucking over to natural gas, but those are really a bit farther out on the horizon.
Right now, we get natural gas mostly by pipeline, Sam.
Yes, and that is, as I'm sure we'll get into deeper into the program, that's the big concern because our pipeline capacity is a bit constrained. During the cold days of the winter, the pipelines are totally full, and some electricity plant or electric generation plants have been having a hard time getting the fuel they need to run.
Yeah, and Greg Lander, Sam gave us the numbers, and they're pretty striking. I'd love your thoughts too on just what a shakeup has occurred in regional energy markets because of this over the last decade.
Well, thank you very much, and glad to be here. What's happened is that the cheapest power plants to build from scratch are natural gas power plants, and as the demand has grown in New England, and the price of natural gas in the United States has gone down, the people who generate electricity have chosen the cheapest alternative to build capacity, meaning the ability to generate electricity from natural gas. But at the same time, they have not built out the pipeline capacity to feed them because the pipeline capacity in New England is built largely to serve the peak demand of the residential and commercial customers in the winter, which in New England has really peaked, but but the rest of the year it's almost unused. And so most of the year the power plants don't have a problem with their capacity, but it's because of the cold all coming at once and the power wanting to go on and the people want to heat their water and oil that causes the problem in the peak winter period.
And where is most of this natural gas, Greg, coming from as it supplies, you know, not just heating but electricity for New England?
Oh, the vast majority will come from the Southwest. Historically, it came from Louisiana and Texas. In the last 5 years, there's been a tremendous growth of natural gas in what's called the Marcellus Shale, which is in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio, and that's much closer to us. And some has come in from Canada, Western Canada. Some has come from Sable Island, which is off of Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and some has come in from LNG ships. Actually, for the last 40 to 50 years, New England has been one of the few places that's been served by LNG almost year-round through the Everett Terminal in Boston.
What's LNG, Greg?
I'm sorry, liquefied natural gas.
Okay.
The gas is frozen into a liquid form at the producing country, put into tankers, shipped on those tankers to ports and terminals. And if you've driven over the Tobin Bridge into Boston, off to your right, there's two big white tanks, and those big white tanks store liquefied natural gas, which enters the system. It's then gasified. It's turned back into a gas and put into the system.
Okay, and here's the big question for all of you gentlemen, but Steve Klemmer, you get to tackle it first. The worry that I've been hearing, at least for the past year, if not longer, is that New England is putting too many eggs in that natural gas basket. We're relying too much on this one particular source of energy for our electricity. What do you think, Steve Klemmer? You first, but I want everybody's thoughts on that. Go ahead, Steve.
Sure. Yeah, we definitely share that concern. The trend that's been happening in New England is really following a national trend. Over the last 5 years, the electricity that we got from coal has declined from about half of our electricity to about 37% in 2012. At the same time, natural gas has increased to about 30% of the country's electricity. So the numbers that Sam threw out for New England show that the problems are even more severe in New England than they are nationally, with the region getting over half of their electricity from natural gas. And the big concerns that we have over that relate to the economic risks of being over-reliant on natural gas. As the prices of gas have been volatile historically, we only have to look back 5 or 6 years to when natural gas prices in the U.S. were spiking and people were shifting away from gas. But the other thing that we have some significant concerns about are the climate risks of over-relying on natural gas. And we're releasing a report tomorrow that gets into more detail on this issue that shows that transitioning from a coal to a natural gas-dominated electricity system would not be sufficient to meet U.S. climate goals.
Well, and natural gas is often called a transition fuel to those sort of cleaner and greener sources, and I definitely want to talk about that. That's a big theme. But to you, too, Sam Evans-Brown, ISO New England, the independent system operator, has voiced these fears that New England has become too reliant on natural gas.
Right, and really, obviously they've been watching the situation for a while and have had it on their radar, but the real trigger event was this past winter. They said they had a razor-thin operating margin before we went to rolling blackouts because constraints on the pipeline infrastructure were such that they couldn't get the gas to the power plants, and it was a cold day. People, obviously, your boiler gets precedence to keep your house warm over some natural gas power plant because there are other plants that can come online instead of that one. So that was the trigger. And they're making a bunch of sort of technical market changes that they think will address that. And it's a lot of very, not exactly, it's very inside baseball. We're talking about coordinating the natural gas market with the wholesale market for electricity so that the markets come online at the same time. We're talking about, signaling a trigger event earlier. So those kind of changes in the near term, but they're also looking to switch their what's called their capacity market. So this is money that they pay to folks who are either own a power plant or are planning to build a power plant just to have that plant there, to have it online, and they're looking to switch that market to reward flexibility, to reward power plants that come online consistently when they say they're going to. And that theoretically will lead to the construction of more power plants that will be more reliable. Even if they are natural gas fired, they have to be able to come online when they say they are.
A lot of technical shifts there. But let me just back up, Sam, if I could, and go to the incident that you talked about, because that really was, you're right, a trigger point for ISO New England to say, whoa, what are we doing here? So back up and walk me through it if you could, Sam. So it got real cold. People turned up their heaters. A lot of them relied on natural gas to heat their homes.
Right, but
that's
also
the priority.
Also, a lot of them rely. There's still plenty of people who rely on electric, you know, baseboard electric heating. So also, those people are turning up their heat.
Got it.
Electric power plants then have to respond to that demand. Many of them are natural gas fired, but the pipelines are at peak capacity, so they can't turn on. So you know, there were other things that were affecting the system at that time that made it a little more complicated than normal, and it got to the point where, you know, if they had lost one power plant or if one power line had gone down in the wrong place, we would have had a real problem.
Wow. So what are your thoughts there too, Greg Lander? Too many eggs in the natural gas basket or not?
Well, in a way, yes, and in a way, no. The way yes is because natural gas has become so inexpensive relative to other fuels, the demand for it has increased accordingly. And in the past, let's say in the years when natural gas was higher priced, the price of natural gas in New England was able to attract LNG supplies on tankers away from Europe and other places, so that there was LNG in the tanks, and when the demands were expressed for electricity, it came out of the tanks, which are located at the far end of the system where you really want the gas to be.
That's at the liquid natural gas that you talked about earlier. Yeah, go ahead.
Gas. And instead of the gas having to come through the pipelines, which are constrained from the southwest, it really comes through both the pipelines and out of the tanks. The problem we see today is really a price problem, because natural gas is so cheap on a year-round basis, the liquefied natural gas to
and
come.
Greg, I got to cut you off there, but I will pick up on that after a super short break, so stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR is partnering with Stay Work Play New Hampshire to present the Rising Stars Awards. NHPR's Virginia Prescott co-hosts the event, celebrating young professionals and innovative companies throughout the state. Get your tickets for the October 7th ceremony at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the Grant Family State Motors Lincoln, with an invitation to view the all-new Lincoln lineup in their showroom and on their lot. State Motors North Manchester, statemotors.com. And Ellen's Interiors, New London in Cambridge, Massachusetts, providing interior design and space planning for your kitchen or bathroom remodeling project. Ellen'sInteriors.com. Mostly sunny across New Hampshire today, highs upper 50s to mid-60s. Mostly clear tonight, some areas of frost after midnight, lows around 30s in Coos County, ranging to around 40 toward the Mass border. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the forecast for natural gas. We're hearing about how it's become New England's preferred energy source, not just for heating, but also for electricity. That's a new development. But as we grow more reliant on this fuel in our region, many are concerned about the reliability of supply as well as possible price hikes. We want your questions and comments on this at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And just before the break, Greg Lander, you were starting to say that in the past, natural gas would come through the pipeline, and what couldn't come through the pipeline could come in on ships in liquefied form. But you seem to be saying that's shifting. Go ahead, Greg, then finish up that point, please.
Right. And so because natural gas in the global market, like Europe, is priced off of oil, it doesn't get attracted to the East Coast of the United States when natural gas in the United States is one quarter of the price of oil. And so what happens is we rely almost entirely on the pipelines, which don't have sufficient capacity to serve all the demands, which causes the prices to go up and the price spikes that we saw last winter. And those price spikes will continue if some sort of plan or some sort of effort isn't made to coordinate making sure there's LNG in the tanks so that when the demand is expressed, it's there to meet that demand. And right now, the market isn't structured in such a way that expensive natural gas can be put in storage and may be used. That's the problem. If it were a known use and a known price, then the market would respond by filling those tanks and keeping them full for when it was needed in the winter.
So, Steve, you said when I asked you the question, you know, are we putting too many eggs in this natural gas basket? You said yes and no. So I'm guessing the supply problems are the yes. What about the no part?
The no part, I think, is that all in all, given that if you can choose between natural gas and coal and oil, overall natural gas is both a plentiful supply, less carbon and cleaner burning, less metallic emissions and whatnot, almost no sulfur emissions. And so that's the no part, which is a heavier reliance on natural gas leads to cleaner air at the same overall energy demand. Unless energy demand goes down, you know, if you have a fixed amount of demand and you have choices as how to fill it, natural gas versus oil is better. Natural gas is better versus coal for those reasons, if the market can respond and make sure the supply is there when you need it.
Well, and Steve Klemmer at the Union of Concerned Scientists, what do you think? Natural gas advertises itself as clean natural gas. How clean is it?
Well, fortunately, coal, oil, and natural gas are not our only alternatives for providing electricity. And I would agree with Greg that some of the advantages that natural gas has over coal and oil from an environmental perspective. But as I was saying earlier, from a climate perspective, if we are too reliant on natural gas for electricity and other uses, it's going to be next to impossible to meet our long-term emission reduction goals to address climate change. There's also, obviously, lots of environmental, public health, and social risks related to fracking, hydrofracking for natural gas. And, you know, so some of the alternatives beyond that that can help diversify our electricity mix and provide price stability and environmental benefits would be to diversify more towards energy efficiency and renewable energy sources. In New Hampshire, for example, utility spending on energy efficiency is resulting in about a 0.6% reduction in electricity sales. According to some national studies, New Hampshire ranks about 18th in the country in terms of investing in energy efficiency. Other states, neighboring states and other states around the country are investing in 2 to 3 times the level of energy efficiency that New Hampshire is. New Hampshire does have a renewable electricity standard of 24% by 2025, which is a great long-term commitment to increasing renewable energy use. But by doing both of those things, that can help reduce some of these economic and environmental risks of going too far with natural gas.
What do you mean going too far, Steve? What's too far in your mind?
Well, right now it's already over half of the state's electricity. I think that's too far. That's going to pose economic risks if natural gas prices increase, which, according to the U.S. Department of Energy, gas prices are projected to rise pretty significantly over the next 20 to 30 years, and that doesn't even include the historic price volatility that we've seen over the past 5 to 10 years. And so if we do see another price spike like we did at that point in time, you know, that's going to be that's going to raise electricity prices, it's going to raise home heating prices, and that's going to have, you know, pretty devastating effects on the economy of New Hampshire, but also the region and the country.
Again, I want to invite our listeners to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us as we talk about the dramatic shift toward natural gas in New England and the concern that you hear expressed these days that we've become too reliant on this fuel. We're looking at the forecast for natural gas, and we want your questions and comments. Where do you see natural gas as forming part of New Hampshire's energy future? Have you switched over to natural gas yourself in your home? How do you feel about it? Are you worried about our level of natural gas use, or do you see it as a better alternative to oil, coal, and nuclear? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Sam and Greg and Steve, let's go to the phones now. And Paul is calling from White River Junction, Vermont. Hi, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. You started to talk about some of these issues, but very quickly, is it definite that fracking is an environmental disaster, or is it a good way of getting the natural gas, number one? Number two, in terms of years, we hear of like 100 years reserve of, say, the tar sands or whatever. What is the number of years calculated for the reserve of natural gas? And third, what is the difference between propane and natural gas? And thank you very much. I'll listen on the radio to hear the answer.
Paul, thank you so much for calling in. And let's talk about fracking first, gentlemen. And Sam Evans Brown, I know you've been looking at this. You know, it isn't just that natural gas burns more cleanly, because it does, than other fossil fuels, but there are big concerns about how you get it out of the ground.
Sure. And I mean, the way that question was posed is exactly the kind of way that we can't answer it. Because, you know, is fracking an environmental disaster, or is it a good way to get it out of the ground? We don't really know, I would say, is the answer. When you depending on what group you're getting your information from, you get both sides. And I think what we're seeing right now is that as people are trying to figure this out, they're coming up with all sorts of answers, depending on exactly what kind of study they're doing, depending on exactly what organization they're looking at. Because, you know, it is clearly true that there have been some irresponsible actors who have been doing fracking and not been doing it correctly, and we've seen, you know, disasters result. But it's also true that there are some, you know, bigger, more well-funded and more experienced organizations that have had many fewer incidents with contaminated groundwater, with you know, escaped chemicals. So I think the jury is still out on fracking, on exactly, you know, where it falls on that spectrum between unmitigated good and you know, pure evil. So that's one side. There's also, when we talk about natural gas and its extraction, we can also talk about leakage, because methane, which is a large component of natural gas, is an extremely potent greenhouse gas, much more potent than carbon dioxide. It's shorter lived in the atmosphere. It breaks down into carbon dioxide, you know, on the scale of 100 years or so. So the accounting gets a little complicated there. But there have been studies that have said that as little as 3.4% of that natural gas leaking out of from wellhead to, you know, to electric plant or to boiler could mean that the climate benefit of switching to gas would be totally eroded.
And if enough methane seeps out.
If we have 3.4% seeping out or more, then, you know, we'd get zero climate change benefit. And again, we don't have a real good accounting on how much is leaking. There was actually a study that just came out yesterday saying that at the production site, it's much lower than previously expected. And it is true that these companies have a profit incentive to let less of it leak than otherwise. So again, we don't really know is the answer. This change is so new. We haven't had a huge amount of time to study exactly the effects that it's had.
Yeah, and to our caller, Paul, there was a report in the New York Times just yesterday, the day before, Sam, that talked about that new study on gas leaks and how some of them might not be as bad as we suspected, but then there are other leaks that perhaps we do need to worry about. Greg Lander, I wonder what you think. You concentrate on the natural gas industry. Is fracking the environmental disaster that our caller worries that it is?
Well, in short, the answer is no, if the techniques that are used are correct and appropriate. Without getting into a deep discussion, fracking has been used in places like New York State for, you know, 40 years and not resulted in groundwater contamination, because in New York, the drillers are required to case to depth, meaning run the pipe all the way to the bottom. In down in the Southwest, where basically below 700 or 800 feet, or maybe even 1,000 feet, the only water that's there is salt water, they don't tend to pipe all the way to the bottom, because even if you did contaminate the water, you're not contaminating potable or drinkable water. Whereas up in the Northeast, you'll find drinkable water down to 5,000, 6,000 feet, which means you have to pipe past the drinkable water so that as the gas and fluids come back up from the fracking, they don't get into aquifers.
You've got to go way, way, way down then, in other words.
Yeah, so there's technical fixes that just cost money. The good players, the good operators, do case deeper and case to depth and prevent the gas from getting into drinkable water aquifers. So I think there's been a lot of to do about it, because there were some bad actors and it made good press and good movies, but. It's a technically solvable problem. It does cost more, but it doesn't make the wells unprofitable.
Steve Clemmer,
I'd
what do you
like
think? Go ahead, Greg, and then I want to hear from Steve on this,
tell
too.
Paul that the reserves of natural gas in the United States are probably on the order of current demand, somewhere between 125 and 150 years of economically recoverable gas at current demand levels.
Wow, that's a lot. I didn't realize there was that much there.
I mean, if you want to think about it, underneath Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, and Ohio, if you go down a mile and a half, there's a carpet of shale, meaning it's just everywhere. You can't miss it. And it varies from a couple hundred feet to 50 feet thick, and it's just everywhere. And inside of it are, you know, billions and billions and billions of cubic feet of natural gas that can be extracted and used.
Well, that raises another question that I had. But first, I want to hear from you, Steve Clemmer. What do you think? Natural gas and the way that it is extracted a lot these days, especially in the Northeast, Pennsylvania, New York, by fracking. Paul has some environmental concerns. What do you think?
Yeah, I definitely share some concerns about some of the environmental and public health risks of natural gas production. You know, every energy source has impacts, and so it's just important to keep them in mind and compare them with other sources. And with fracking, you know, some of the issues have been talked about, but there's a lot of chemicals that are used in the fracking fluid, many of which have been identified as toxic. Now, there haven't been too many incidences of where fracking fluid has contaminated drinking water supplies, but that potential does exist. And we know that some of the chemicals that are used are cause cancer and are toxic. And one of the big problems with that issue is that the chemical disclosure of the fluid is not regulated very well, either at the state or federal level, and those regulations could be much stronger. Sam mentioned the methane leakage issue, which is a problem as well, and you know, erodes some of the climate advantages that natural gas would have over coal. And the number that he threw out, the 3.4% or 3%, needs to be put in a little context. That number, there's a lot of assumptions that go into whether natural gas is better than coal. And that particular study looked at methane over a much shorter period of time, which is it's a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. If you look at it over a longer period of time, like let's say 100 years instead of 25 years, you know, the leakage rate could be higher than that, and gas could still be better than coal. So you need to consider the time frames, although in the short term, one of the issues is that, you know, from a climate perspective, is that we could hit tipping points that could be irreversible. And so, you know, limiting the use of natural gas in the short term is also important from a climate perspective. You know, there are other issues related to the disposal of the waste fluid that comes out of the ground from fracking, some of which can be toxic. There's increased truck traffic and air pollution related to the trucking of water to and from the site. there's also impacts of mining the sand that's used for fracking, which comes from a handful of states. And so all of these issues, you know, need to be addressed, and there's a lot of exemptions that the industry currently has, both at the state and federal level, and those regulations need to be stronger and some of these exemptions that are in place removed so that we can adequately protect the environment and public health.
Well, Paul, lots of questions from that call. Thank you very much for joining us. The number for you to take part in our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at the huge increase in natural gas use here in New England. What role do you see natural gas playing in New England's energy future? The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. So here's another big question for all of you. And Sam, I'll turn to you first, I think. So our caller, Paul, was wondering about the environmental risks of natural gas, and all three of you seem to say, you know, there are some, but there's a balanced or a nuanced view as to how bad they are. But every energy source has impacts. Alternatives like wind and hydro and biomass here in New Hampshire, Sam, have also had troubles. So when folks have a problem with natural gas, what's the alternative?
Well, it depends who you ask.
Right. Really, I mean, that's the big question.
Yeah. And what we're seeing now is that for years there were all sorts of rosy studies coming out about the distribution. If we had a widely distributed network of renewable generation of wind and solar that was well connected, the sunny spots in one part of the country would outweigh the windy spots in another part of the country. But what we're seeing now is that it's really a lot more complicated than that to hook large amounts of renewables up onto the grid, just for technical reasons. I mean, if a cloud passes over a huge bank of solar panels, the voltage drops, and again you get into a problem where you could have blackouts because the grid is, there's not enough voltage on the system to keep the electrons flowing. So it's an open question where we're going to get our electricity from, and I think that every actor in the market has a different answer.
All right. We will talk more after a short break, and we'll take more of your calls. So stay with us if you're on the line at 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 938, and good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, gun violence and the debate over gun control legislation. Then, from the Manhattan Project to today, the challenges of securing America's nuclear arsenal. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show, this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, helping you create eco-friendly sleep environments, also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. And from New Hampshire Orthopedic Center, keeping bodies in motion, on the web at nhoc.com. Mostly sunny today, high temperatures upper 50s to mid-60s, mostly clear. Tonight, some areas of frost after midnight, lows from lower 30s in Cohos County ranging to around 40 along the Mass border. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we look at the next big phase in the Affordable Care Act, the rollout of health insurance exchanges, the online marketplaces where people are supposed to be able to shop for health coverage. Find us on Facebook at NHPR Exchange to join our conversation ahead of the show, and then be sure to join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at New England's preferred energy source, natural gas, and the question of whether we become too reliant on this fuel. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Greg Lander, Sam Evans Brown, Steve Klemmer, I want to just quickly finish up what we were talking about before the break, Sam, and that is, you know, people have concerns about being over-reliant on natural gas, and yet, you know, the alternatives have had a hard time gaining a foothold here in New Hampshire too. Go ahead, Sam, and then I want to hear from everybody else on this as well.
And I just wanted to clarify. I mean, I you know, problems with renewables sure are occurring, but it's everyone who I've talked to has stressed that these are technical problems that will have technical solutions. So there are lots of very smart engineers trying to work all these things out. And while there are problems right now, it's also a huge growth industry for people who want to get into this and try to find a solution, because we are in the middle of a huge paradigm shift and it will take very smart minds to get it sorted.
Okay, but what incentive do those minds have, Sam, if natural gas is cheap and, as Greg said, there's 125 years of it?
Well, gas won't be cheap forever. I mean, if you look at the market forecasts, I mean, we're even in the next couple, 5 years, they're looking at gas getting to the point where coal could again start to get a little bit of a foothold in the New England electric market. So, I mean, not as much as it was before, but again, gas is in 20 years probably is going to be, we're going to be at a point where energy is more expensive again. I mean, really, gas, for all of its the downsides that we've been talking about here, has meant incredibly cheap electricity and energy for all the industries in New England, and it's been a huge economic boon in the past 5 years.
Let's take another call, gentlemen. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Jay is on the line. Hi, Jay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My question was, when are we going to start thinking longer term than just 100 years or 150 years that, you know, natural gas is going to last? You know, I'm against nuclear power the way we've done it, but why can't we spend some of the money that the oil companies make right now on research into thorium nuclear reactors that, you know, are much less radioactive, and thorium has a half-life of 300 years instead of 30,000 years. We looked at that back in, the 50s, and you couldn't make bombs out of it, so we stopped researching it. But, I drive a car. I heat my house with, a kerosene heater, and so, we're all in it together. Why can't we start using some of the money to look further down the road than just 150 years? I have two daughters, and, let's look further down the road than just 150 years.
Jay, thank you very much for calling in. We're getting into some of these bigger, broader issues. What do you think? Greg, I'll turn to you first. Go ahead.
Well, I think, first of all, over 150 years, not only are we talking about alternative ways of generating electricity, but we're talking about, there's also methane in what's called methane ice, or I forget the name now, of course, but there's huge, huge deposits off the Gulf Coast, off the Atlantic coast, of this methane ice, which is recoverable. I think in the long term, we have to look at both the supply side and the demand side. Energy efficiency is very important and should be paramount in all of our thinking, because an energy kilowatt not used means a supply not called forth, and that is probably the largest single place that we can look to going down the road, is using the energy we use more efficiently. We're continuously using it more efficiently as we go forward from 60s to now, but there's probably another 50 to 60% more efficiency that can be used or be realized in appliances, in homes, in cars and trucks and whatnot. And if I were to say where's the most fertile ground to begin looking at the totality of the problem, is to begin looking at the end use, making our computers shut off and not use power when they're not, running. Our refrigerators not use power when they're not running and whatnot, because that kind of, wasted use of power is gigawatts on a national basis.
Now then you don't have to build a new natural gas plant. And Steve Klemmer, I'd love your thoughts too before we go back to our listeners on this idea that Jay expresses. Let's look way beyond natural gas and what we're doing right now.
Yeah, the caller's right. We need to look long term, but there's also an urgency to get this right in the short term. You know, if we could get decision makers to look out even 5 or 10 years or 20 years, that would be great. All of the decisions are really focused on short term. And the reason why there's an urgent need to get this right is because Americans are already experiencing damaging and costly impacts from climate change and extreme weather events, including things like droughts and wildfires, flooding, you know, coastal storms and so forth. And all of these are being exacerbated by climate change. And given the 30 to 60 year lifetime of most new power plant investments, including gas plants, the choices we make now are going to greatly influence whether we can avoid some of the worst impacts of climate change. And the caller brought up nuclear as a solution, and certainly nuclear power does not emit carbon dioxide and has advantages from that standpoint, but it's the big issue really is one of cost, the cost of building new nuclear power plants in the U.S., which we're seeing from a handful of projects that are being built in the Southeast, are incredibly expensive, and there's really a lot of other alternatives that are lower cost. As Greg was saying, efficiency is probably the cheapest and fastest option we can deploy. You know, as I said earlier, New Hampshire could do 2 to 3 times the level of efficiency that they're currently doing while saving consumers money. Renewable energy technologies, wind and solar, you know, they do have environmental impacts like every technology does, but I would submit that those impacts are far less than natural gas, far less than coal for sure, and nuclear.
So picking up on what you said about the choices that we make today, Steve, in terms of how we choose to invest in energy, what types of power plants we do choose to build, how is the current favoritism, if I could call it that, towards natural gas affecting the choices that we make? Is it, you know, still considered a transition fuel, or is it crowding out investment in, you know, greener sources like wind, solar, hydro, whatever?
I think it's actually a little bit of both. It is being certainly used as a transition fuel away from coal. But as I said earlier, the question is how far are we going to go with that? And the low price of natural gas is certainly making it economic issues for things like wind and solar to compete. But at the same time, the good news is that the price of wind and solar has also been coming down dramatically. Over the last 3 years, the price of wind has fallen by about 40%. The cost of solar has fallen by 60% over the last 2 years. And so in places in the country, in good wind resource areas of the country, wind is already competing with new natural gas power plants. The other advantage that they have, as well as energy efficiency, is that they can be deployed relatively quickly, in, you know, a year or two or even less than a year. Whereas natural gas plants will take a few years to build, nuclear power plants will take, you know, at least 5 to 10 years before we're going to see them come online to generate electricity. So renewables and efficiency also have that advantage of being able to be deployed very quickly to help reduce emissions and other environmental impacts.
And I want to return, gentlemen, from the big picture that we've been talking about, you know, 5 years out, even 100 years out, as Jay suggests, and back to this winter, Greg Lander. And it was mentioned earlier, I think Sam Evans Brown told the story about how we got pretty close to having some brownouts and a bit of a crisis here in New England when we had a cold snap and natural gas supplies were getting pretty tight coming into the region. So what about this winter? If we have another cold one, which the Old Farmer's Almanac says we will, what can we expect in terms of that natural gas flowing through the pipelines to our homes, flowing to the utilities and coming into the ports, as you said? Will we have enough?
Well, one of the things that the New England ISO has tried to do, and I believe successfully accomplished, is that they put in place a what I think they call it something like an emergency procurement, where they are going to collect money from ratepayers in their electric charges to fund the ability for the oil generators to fill their tanks with oil so that oil will be there to generate electricity if natural gas becomes constrained, which is an environmentally less advantaged way to solve it, but it will solve the physical supply problem. And there was a lot of debate earlier this summer and last spring over whether a liquefied natural gas alternative to the oil should be considered, and that was turned down by the New England ISO at that time. So this coming winter, to the extent there is a supply problem on the natural gas side, it will be met by oil that's been paid for by all of us ratepayers and put in tanks to be there when needed.
Interesting. Sam?
I think it's important to point out that, you know, worrying whether or not the lights are going to come on during a cold snap is kind of misplaced. I mean, that's what the ISO is there for. Their job is to make sure the lights come on. Whether or not that electricity is coming from natural gas at these coldest days, that it might be the case that it's coming from oil. It might be the case that the market enhancements that they've made to coordinate better with natural gas, the natural gas pipelines, make it that we don't get into this situation again. But again, that's what the ISO is there for. They are federally mandated to make sure that as often as possible, the lights come on when you hit the switch.
All right, let's take another call if we could. And Frank's joining us from Brookline. Hi, Frank. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Well, you just spoke about my real serious thing is, you know, these electric gas plants have interruptible service, and when their supply is short to heat homes, they shut these guys off and they turn on the oil burners. There was a plant in Pepperell, Mass. That burned 3,000 gallons of oil an hour, and that drives everybody's oil bill up to the roof because now you get all these other guys fishing out of the same pond. And, you know, I can put 300 gallons of oil in my tank in the cellar, but anybody with natural gas, you know, if there's nothing coming up the street, there's nothing heating your home. And you know, somehow the regulatory guys got to deal with some of that. And the Edison plant has already started laying in a big stock of bunker oil in order to generate electricity this winter. And, you know, Farmer's Almanac says it's going to be screaming cold. Woolly caterpillars are looking like a big cat winter, you know. But that's the only signs we have to go on. You know, the hornet's nests are tall in the trees.
Right. And Frank, you know, reliability, it's a big concern. I think that's what we're hearing. And I think you addressed it somewhat, Sam, but I wonder if you jump in there again if you want. I mean,
sure.
That's the worry.
Yeah. And I think again, it should be pointed out that homes and home heating always gets precedence over these generation plants because you can say, okay, that you know, electric plant can't run, but we'll turn on an oil-fired one. But people don't have two boilers in their basement. So,
right.
So always home heating gets precedence there.
Yeah. So just looking ahead, gentlemen, and Steve, I think I'll turn to you first. What are your hopes in terms of natural gas and whether in the next decade or so it'll continue to play this 50 or 52% role in terms of New England's electric generation? Do you think that's going to go down in the next 10 years or up?
Well, I hope it goes down. I think, you know, there is an appropriate role for natural gas to play. I don't think it's for natural gas to supply a large baseload electricity to the grid for the long term because, as I said earlier, there's a serious risk about us meeting our long-term climate goals because even though gas has less CO2 than coal, it still emits a significant amount of CO2. And so just to let me describe some of what I think appropriate uses and roles for natural gas would be. One is that, you know, as we increase the contribution from renewables, particularly wind and solar, gas can play a really complementary role to that by because it can be ramped up fairly quickly and ramped down quickly.
So plugging the holes, so to speak.
Well, it can provide flexibility to the grid when the wind's not blowing or the sun's not shining. Another good use for gas, because of its quick ramping ability, it's likely to remain a source for providing peak electricity generation, as well as another technology that is an efficient way to use natural gas is to use combined heat and power that produces both electricity and heat that can be used. And some of these plants that are out there are up to twice as efficient as a standalone natural gas plant that only generates electricity. And then in the long term, you know, if natural gas is going to play a role from a climate perspective, it's going to need to be combined with carbon capture and storage. And that obviously comes at a cost and affects the efficiency of the plant. But for natural gas to play that role and for us to address climate change, that would need to happen long term.
Well, and real quick, because we're nearing the end, Greg Lander, you too. Let's just give you a 5-year horizon. Will natural gas still provide half of New England's electricity?
I think natural gas will end up somewhere around 62 to 65% on an annual basis, and that it will be supplemented with renewables. It will be supplemented with demand response, which is the ability to stop using power and getting paid to stop using power, just like people pay to use power.
Getting a little more flexible, as Sam Evans Brown said. So I heard you right, Greg, 65% you think natural gas will provide of our electric supply here in New England?
By 2023, yes.
Wow. Okay. Thank you very much for being with us, Greg. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Greg Lander, owner of Skipping Stone, a professional resources and energy consulting firm. Steve Klemmer, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Steve Klemmer, Director of Energy Research at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Sam Evans Brown, thank you also for being here.
Happy to be here.
Sam Evans Brown, Environment Reporter for NHPR. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is John Barrett. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the next big phase of the Affordable Care Act. Enrollment begins soon for the online health insurance exchanges or marketplaces. So far in this state, only one insurer is taking part with a product that offers lower cost but a narrower network. We'll look at the rollout of this one component of Obamacare and what it could mean for the Granite State. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Small Dog Electronics, hosting an iPad seminar open to the public today at the Palace Theater, covering the iPad as a valuable business tool. Registration at smalldog.com/seminars. And from Kingdom County Productions, presenting Cassandra Wilson, classic jazz singer and songwriter, at 7 p.m. this Sunday at Fuller Hall, St. Johnsbury Academy. Tickets at kingdomcounty.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts of George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. Yesterday morning, a former Navy reservist shot and killed 12 people at the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard before he was killed by police. The mass shooting at a secure military facility was the deadliest such attack since a gunman killed 26 at a Connecticut school last year. The suspect in the Navy Yard